Hello, and welcome to Essential Work, exploring the past, present, and future of jobs. This podcast brought to you by the Battle of Homestead Foundation. I'm Nathan Ruggles. Thank you for listening. Each week, we bring you stories and struggles, people and perspectives, interviews and commentaries, all on the world of work, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Here in our 13th episode, we discuss microloans with Pauline Greenlick and Dr. Louis Picard, founders of the nonprofit ASA Social Fund for Hidden Peoples. It's a three-part interview in which we look at their work through our unique lens of past, present, and future. We set the stage and take a look back in part one, up next. Welcome back. This is Nathan Ruggles here with you for our feature interview with my two guests here. First of all, we have Pauline Greenlick. Pauline is an educator, a filmmaker, a founder and treasurer of the organization ASA Social Fund for Hidden Peoples. She has taught for over 30 years with students with special needs. She's produced over 30 films focusing on the stories of hidden people in Uganda in particular. And she's also, we should say, an active member of the Battle of Homestead Foundation. Welcome, Pauline. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
And I also have Dr. Lou Picard. He is a co-founder and the president of ASA. He's a professor of international development, Africa, and Middle East studies at the University of Pittsburgh. That's in their Graduate School of Public and International Affairs, or GISPIA. He also provides policy and program leadership with ASA, and he is the one that has developed and managed the Micro Enterprise Development Program in Uganda, which we're going to be talking about today. Lou, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
So again, welcome to you both. So glad to have you here on the program. And Lou, if I could start with you. When we talk about microloans, could you just define that for us? What do you mean by a microloan?
Well, microloans are very small loans. In the international context, probably anywhere from $50 to $500, but depending on the country that you're looking at. These are loans that are too small for banks and too small for other lending organizations. And they're really focused on people who want to start very small businesses, but also want to get into income-generating activities.
Okay. Well, very good. Thank you for setting the stage for us. Now, as you know, with our program, we like to go into the past as well as talk about the present and into the future. So I would like to go back in the past here. Pauline, how did you first hear about microloans? Where were you? How did it happen?
Okay, I'll have to admit, I really didn't know even what a microloan was about 8-9 years ago.
But is it fair to say you're both experts on it at this point, pretty much?
And now, still, we're in the learning phase.
Okay.
Phases. I think we'll always will be. But during one of our early trips to Uganda in 2011, I met with some of the friends of my husband's who works at a bank called Centenary Bank. And Centenary Bank is mainly located in Uganda. And we talked to the president of the bank because, you know, our friend had worked there and had us work there. So when we visited him, he was talking about all the wonderful things his bank does. And surprisingly, it's really run by the Catholic Church. And in fact, in their office building, they even have a church, you know, so people can attend mass. So they talked about many of the things about banking and businesses in Uganda, and I wasn't that interested until he talked about this term called microloans. And he said that about 30% of the loans of this bank do go for microloans and for people who, you know, we're talking 50, like what Lou was saying, $50 to $500. And that is how they have grown. They go into the villages in Uganda and they give training to these very small business people. And these are people that you would see selling tomatoes on the street or trying to get their auto repair shop going. And I was just so impressed that this bank was doing that. And so that was my first really introduction into microloans. And we had heard success stories about how the people were able to get one loan, then another and another. And I just remember one man now owned his entire business and was doing quite well for himself with based on this little microloan he got from Centenary Bank. And then we went up to Gulu and we met some of the bank people there at the Centenary Bank. And Gulu is a very northern country that had been devastated and hit hard by the war. And at that day,
and where was this relative from where you first?
In Kampala.
In Kampala.
About 400 miles.
400. Okay.
Yeah.
The bank is not just in Kampala. It's not just in the
capital. It's everywhere. They have branches. Okay. So we went to the branch in Gulu, which is a good 6-hour drive north and right near the border of Sudan, and had, and there, when we walked in, there was a whole line of people, and the man said that they're all there ready to pay their loans today. So we were really encouraged by that, and that is how I really learned about microloans. And so my ears really perked up when we were talking about it.
And as you were saying, these were local business people in right there in the community.
Exactly. And like I said, from what I learned is that they do go on a motorcycle way out into the hinterlands in the rural areas, and they and people who are interested in getting a microloan, they do give them training and on how to manage their business, just basic bookkeeping training. And then, you know, hopefully they'll be paying back their loans and be very successful and be able to support their families. So that was my first introduction to it.
Now, Lou, if you could give us some background here. So why were you in Uganda in the first place? I mean, what was it that led you okay. to encounter this? Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I'm an Africanist. I teach and write about Africa, not all 54 countries, but I've worked in close to 40 of them. But my first country, I was in the Peace Corps for 3 years, was Uganda. And okay. so we went back in 2008 and began to look around for ideas we might have to get re-involved.
And 2008 was a few years after comment. You had been there. I'm sorry, 2008 must have been a few years after you had originally been.
Yeah, we had had Uganda had faced a rocky post-independence period. Mostly bad government, some very bad government. Most people listening, if they know anything about Uganda, probably remember Idi Amin and the horrible almost 10 years that he brought to the place. But before and after, there were equally bad governments. And of course, as a result, Uganda has been in civil war for most of its post-independence period. So for many years, I had worked in other African countries, but not gone back to Uganda prior to 2008.
And when was independence roughly?
1962. That's a while ago. Yeah.
Appeared when a number of African countries were.
Yes, that was part of the independence period, right in the heart of all of the independence granted to French and British and other colonial administrations to their now former colonies.
So you had this time and experience in Africa and these different countries, and then you decided then to come back at that later time.
Yeah, come back to Uganda. But again, I had been working in South Africa, doing research. I've been working in West Africa, been working in the Horn of Africa. This was either teaching, but also doing consulting work for United Nations, World Bank, and USAID, and also, of course, writing articles and books about the place, the continent, so to speak. And so, it was kind of a return to home to go back to Uganda in 2008 and to think about it. And fortunately, we met people that were friends of friends, and we clicked with partners there, and so we developed a permanent relationship, which continues today.
Yeah, and Pauline, you had something to add there.
Yeah, I wanted to add because I did not know Lou when he was in the Peace Corps. So we had decided in 2008 to make this really great trip. And we took a whole month, and Lou wanted to show me all the places that he had been to when he was in his 20s. And I just thought this was so much fun. And so we were in Kenya, then Uganda, and Tanzania. So I got to see where Lou put gas in his cars and his motorcycle and where he got his food and groceries and where he lived. And it was really a joy. And so Lou had a really great friend, and I know Lou can talk a little more about him, Manuel Pinto, who was a great friend in the Peace Corps. And I was so eager to meet him. And we had talked with him on the phone in April of 2008. And he had always been very close with Lou, and Lou had always communicated with him. So about 2 months, 3 months before we got to Uganda, he died. And it was really an accident. He was fixing his car. And you know how people in developing countries, even here, will put a rock or something in front of the wheels if they're on a hill. Car gave way and crushed him. Oh. So I never got to meet him. That's really made him, you know, very sad. And so when we got to Uganda, yeah, it was. And I know Lou was devastated because they were close. And he was there at their wedding in the 60s, and when he got married, and he was the godfather to their firstborn son. So I knew this was a close relationship. So when we got to Uganda in July of 2008, we met with his widow, who Lou did know he was close to, and his son was there to help his mom settle the estate. So then they said, "Would you like to see the projects that my dad had worked on?" We said, "Sure." And he said it was an orphanage. And so that's how we met up with Victoria Nalongo Namasisi and Bright Kids Uganda through this relationship with Lou's friend. So that was a sad and bittersweet type of situation for us. So I'm glad we were there at that time. And then, you know, the rest is history. But I'm sure Lou could talk more about it, because that was just me as an outsider. Never been to East Africa except that first time.
So you were there in East Africa in those three countries for a month?
And then
Lou, could you talk a little more about that, your encounter with the Bright Kids organization and how
sure.
that happened?
Well, we struck up a relationship with Bright Kids right away. And between 2008 and now, except for most of last year, We went back to Uganda at least once a year, sometimes twice. We actually were last in Uganda in 2020 in January, just before things collapsed with the pandemic. So this is one of our longest stretches of not being there. But the focal point was, in fact, that these kids were all abandoned kids. They were street kids. They and then their mothers and parts of their family were either victimized or in some way marginalized by either war or gender violence, acid attacks, unfortunately, or through discrimination based upon physical or mental challenges. Our interest then became on creating an opportunity for people to survive these tragedies and this marginalization, focusing on health and on education, and then increasingly being convinced that income generation was an important component of both the people who were marginalized, but also for those that are trying to work with them. Money doesn't grow on trees, and it doesn't come easily, particularly internationally. So that was how we started ASA Social Fund for Hidden Peoples. Focused in Uganda, but based in the U.S.
So yeah, whether those trees are in Africa or here, it doesn't grow on them, does it?
No, it doesn't. No trees like that.
And now, for those who aren't familiar, when you say acid attack, if you could, talk.
Unfortunately, it is pretty graphic. It basically means that some kind of acid, usually battery acid, is collected and physically actually thrown at the face or the body of the victim. Many of them are women, and for domestic reasons, or in some cases that's used as a weapon of revenge or business competition. There are all kinds of reasons that it happens. And by the way, it does happen in this country, not very often, but it does. And it certainly happens in other parts of the world.
And how long has that sort of terrible attack been? How long have these been taking a place in Uganda?
I think it's gotten worse over time, but we know of it at least going back through the 80s. And we also know that because Uganda was in civil war, and it's the kind of civil war that involved children who were kidnapped and involved child brides and so forth, it was a part of one of many different ways in which people could get marginalized, injured, or of course killed. And so we decided on the term hidden peoples to describe why they have been marginalized outside of the society and really kept apart, neglected, hidden away, and not assisted.
And Pauline, could you maybe just talk a little bit more about, I don't know if you have any stories or examples of of what some of these families and women or children, what they've been going through there in Uganda, in their society in the past, that you encountered as you were starting the organization?
Oh, I have many stories. One in particular I remember, a friend of ours named Silver Onyo. He was blinded when he contracted measles when he was 4 years old. He was, unfortunately, it was circumstance. He was born in the northeastern part of Uganda during the Lord's Resistance Army War, and there weren't any vaccinations, no medical care, etc. Lots of kids were going blind because of measles and other diseases. So Silver is now a grown man. He's got a family. And I talked to him because I was interested in those with disabilities, because I was a special education teacher, and we really didn't see people with disabilities around Uganda at all. And I said, where are they? And they said, they're hidden. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, anybody with a disability is considered a curse on the family. So one visit, I told Silver that Lou and I would like to accompany him to his town, which was about a good 10-hour drive. It took a long time to drive there. And he gathered together groups of people with disabilities as we drove along. And the very, very first person we met was a little family, a woman and a child, about 9 years old, on the side of the road. And we got off out of the car and we walked with her. And as we're walking to go to her hut, and because the car couldn't go any further, and then the woman next to me said, well, you know, the family wants this child dead, because if there's any food, it goes to the healthy ones. If there's any medicine, it goes to the ones who can survive. And this girl had, I would say, cerebral palsy. Not being a medical person, but she definitely, but it was surprising because you could tell in her eyes, she was active, you know, and recognizing us. When we got to her hut, she took us to where she slept. She smiled, she played around, and it was just heartbreaking to see this child not being wanted and not being needed. Yet I believe with some education, with some care and concern, this child probably could become a productive, person in society. And there's just countless stories of people who are blind. And actually in Uganda, people are trying to help them. There's a small group of organizations that do want to help those with physical disabilities, those who are blind, those who can't hear, those with cerebral palsy, the big heads, hydrocephalic kids, you see them around, and it's because of the poor medical care. So, like I said, there's just tons of stories, and But what we did see that there was a real small core of people who really wanted to help these people and bring them out into the open, help them, give them an opportunity to get an education of some sort and hopefully a job and a life and a family. So that was my first introduction to hidden people. And that's where the term came out as we were driving along and then talking to Victoria about this, because she said, yes, she confirmed people are hidden in this society. And so we had, Lou and I had written a paper about the children, the hidden people. And I realized that Uganda has an unbelievable amount of great laws for the disabled, but they aren't implemented at all. If I had broken my leg, I wouldn't be able to get around Uganda hardly at all. Or if I had lost sight, it'd be very, very difficult. The laws are there, but nobody implements them. So we wanted to bring this out into the open, and we wanted to make people aware of this, give these people an opportunity to get an education and a job. And we have a lot of success stories of women, mainly a lot of women. There are some men who now are doing very well. And it just brings joy to your heart to see them, you know, flourish.
Well, I definitely want to get to those success stories. But first, mm-hmm. I have to say, you know, obviously from what you're saying, the idea of hidden peoples was something you specifically very consciously chose because that's what was going on. And as myself, as someone who has been involved for some time in volunteering with the blind community and with audio description for the blind and visually impaired, I certainly have a knowledge and sensitivity to what that means. And I think it is fair to say that we may take it for granted now in this country that we have the Americans for Disabilities Act that is a law and is enforced, at least to a degree in a lot of places, one degree or another, that's not the way it always was. Even here in, you know, Western society, right? And people were hidden at one time here as well, correct?
Right. As I was going through all of my classes and with special education classes, you know, there were all these stories where these kids were kept in attics and hidden away. And it's such a joy as a teacher now. That started in the 70s, really. Her parents, there are a group in Pennsylvania. I'm beginning to lose all of my previous knowledge I had learned. But it took a strong parent group to really get this law going in the United States. And it has truly, it's been a real struggle. And when I'm, as a special education teacher, you know, you had to really empower these parents to push. Because even in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s when I was teaching, it still was a struggle to get these kids to have a fair and appropriate education and an opportunity in life to move on.
Well, it also strikes me as well that we also take for granted measles vaccines here in this country.
Oh, right.
And mm-hmm. and that is, again, not always available to everyone in this world, even today.
And clean water, right. Clean water causes river blindness, you know, the bad water causes river blindness. The, you know, poor maternal health when a mother is pregnant. If that baby loses oxygen coming out, it could have cerebral palsy. You know, all sorts of things and malnutrition for both mom and child. All of the, there are just countless factors. And that's why there's so many children with disabilities in Uganda and developing countries when they don't have things that, like you said, we take for granted.
Well, I appreciate you both kind of giving us some detailed background to help folks understand what's going on there. We definitely want to hear more details about those success stories and about the microloan program with the ASA Social Fund for Hidden Peoples. But we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back here in a moment with Pauline Greenlick and Lou Picard. We are back with Pauline Greenlick and Lou Picard of the ASA Social Fund for Hidden Peoples. We're talking about microloan programs and what they mean for the lives of recipients, particularly in Uganda. So if you could, Lou, talk a little bit more about microloans and who do they go to? What kind of terms that they have? How did you decide to set the terms that they do have?
Right. Well, first of all, let me just say, microloans are not easy. They're not easy because whether it's large or small, people don't like to pay back loans, or they're not able to pay back loans.
Sure.
So that's a factor. So the way you structure these loans, small though they are, is important. So let me just take a particular group and sort of take you through the process very, very briefly.
Very good.
Two of the groups we're working with in northern Uganda are essentially girls now in their middle age who started out as child brides, were kidnapped by something called the Lord's Resistance Army, which was a rebel group that fought horribly nasty civil war from 1986 to 2008, and are still not out of the picture.
So for over 20 years and even ongoing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they're still wandering around Eastern Central Africa, Central African Republic, South Sudan, and the Congo. But they're no longer in Uganda. They've been shoved out. But these are women who were kidnapped. Many of them fought as child soldiers, but they became child brides when they're about 12, 14 years old, started having kids. Many of them grew up and ended up as adults, still married or still in the Lord's Resistance Army. Some of them went back to the bush with the kids. So when the army LRA left, it left a lot of these people. They went back to society to try to integrate in. But of course, they are hidden because they're shamed. Their children are shamed because of what they went through. And so this particular group is another part of our category of hidden peoples, not because of disease or because of special needs, but just because of what happened to them. So the operation that we set up is one that's used in other parts of the world, and it's sort of a group situation. We have set up a group of seven people who work together and who act as a group recipient of loan money, but distributed to the members of the group in order to let them get started on an activity that generates income. Could be manufacturing something, baskets, it could be selling something, could be repairing something, radios, for example, or more likely in this day and age, cell phones. It could be agricultural development. And we start out with a loan of perhaps we started with $50, but more likely now we go to about $100, and they grow up to about $500 if it works. They have to pay the money back. If they do pay the money back, we then grant them a second and then a third and a fourth loan, increasing the amount, so they're increasing the scale of their investment in their business. The other thing is that's important is we try to ensure that they get as much training as possible. Our current focus is really on training because, like everything else, business and business activity does not, come naturally to people. It's something they need to work on and developed.
It's not necessarily taught in school, right?
And
knowledge of how to run a business, right?
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. So, we use a much lower, interest rate than is normal in, developing countries. In Uganda, 24% interest is a pretty normal rate. That will be shocking to us, of course, to have to pay back. And that means only very wealthy people can get access to loans. We actually use a very high rate by American standards, 12%, but it's half of the normal. It's about as low as one can go given that we need to ensure that the loans are not only repaid, but that we have more money to reinvest in the loans themselves, with next generation growth. So that's essentially the pattern. We're growing slowly. We're also, of course, involved in other kinds of grant activity, either for infrastructure, perhaps related to income generation, investing heavily in training. And of course, we want to see that both education and health needs are addressed. So there are fundraising activities focused on these areas as well. But we feel that the model of the income generation, the entrepreneurialism, is important. And it's something that we seek to sustain. But again, we don't have 100% success rate. Again, we've had some bad situations in the past, bad loans, and we've tried to learn from them. And of course, we thought we were learning in January of 2020, because we went out and did a more extended process called training of trainers. And we saw clear sailing, of course, for 2020 and 2021. But of course, the COVID hit just after we left, and Uganda now is under lockdown with the so-called Delta wave coming their direction, and with only 2% of the population of 44 million people vaccinated, and they have almost no vaccine. So we're quite worried, of course. We're not quite sure. We know that our recipients are all locked down with everybody else. Their businesses have been closed. They've been closed off and on for most of last year and most of this year. So we're very concerned. We're also concerned because, of course, of the exposure and the fact that most people there have not yet been hit by the COVID. It's a very similar situation to what we saw happen not long ago in India, which is not a very optimistic future. But I did want to make sure that people understood that we're in a very difficult situation right now.
So, but also, while here I was going to say, just while here we, in many ways, at least think we're coming out of this thing, it's we have to understand that's not the way it is all over the world right now, and that's just one example where folks are in the midst of it. Pauline, did you have something to add there?
Sounds like- yeah, I wanted to add, because Lou just briefly mentioned it's a group loan. And when we started these, they were individuals, and we were getting a high no payment rate. So we heard about this Grameen Bank. Lou knew all about it, method where you have a group. So if one person can't pay, the whole group can't get a loan. So it's a lot of group peer pressure, and that has worked really miracles in having people pay back their loan.
Okay, so you overcame that. You've learned and then overcame and made some changes as a result. Any other challenges that you encountered from the time that you started that you've had to face, or that those receiving the loans have had to learn and learn?
Yeah,
and face
the big challenge, of course, is trying to do this from 10,000 miles away.
Sure.
And before this year, we were going over once or twice a year. We're still not convinced that that's enough. But not having been there for the last almost 18 months has been very difficult.
Yeah, and the other challenge is that many of the people do not have an education. I know Lou had touched upon this earlier, and but this doesn't mean that they couldn't learn. I mean, their intelligence level is quite high, and their desire to learn is really there. And when we had talked to the loan recipients, they all said, we want training. And even when they got their basic training, they wanted more training, additional training. So, yeah. And so the desire to have an education, even if it's in a short little, group sort of situation, it doesn't matter, and they get a certificate, and it has really made a difference in the payback of the loans. But yeah, this has been a real challenging situation now, because people can't sell anything. I mean, we're talking one thing, you know, Uganda has a dictatorship, and so he can close down. The only good thing is he can really close down everything, and people have to listen. So right now, everybody is really hurting. They, like Lou had said, our group in Gulu was doing really well. They paid back their loan. They were excited. And then all of a sudden, they can't go out and sell their goods on the street. So they're all
struggling. Due to the pandemic mm-hmm. or due to the, okay.
Yeah, due to the pandemic. And this is really devastating. You know, we're worried about how we're all going to rebound here in the United States, you know, monetarily wise. But boy, there, I don't know. It's really going to be interesting. We're in close contact with our, especially with Victoria. We just talked to her the other day, always going through WhatsApp, exchanging messages. And we were hoping we would be there right now or even in August or maybe even November. But I'm not too sure, you know, now. We'll see what happens. If they can get vaccinations out there and start vaccinating a lot of people, that's the only way this is going to come to an end. Otherwise, I really don't know. It's devastating for them.
Well, small business people here have, mm-hmm. and in this country, certainly have had a lot of challenges and difficulties through this pandemic. If people can only imagine what it'd be like to not have the sort of government support or programs that we've had here that have at least, you know, assisted folks. How much more challenging it would be to be a small business person. So with the pandemic, how has that impacted the ability for folks to pay back these loans?
Well, it has impacted, and we're in a situation of suspension right now. We're not sending any more money out at this point. We want to try to support people. We had developed a program of support before the second wave hit, based on the fact that we would ask them to pay back a small amount of their old loan and to provide them with additional support through a new loan, but at a higher interest rate. Those that did pay back, we would go down to 10%, that would provide some incentive. But, until they opened it up, there's not much we can do. When I say a lockdown, this is a total lockdown, more like you might have seen in some of the European countries here. It means no driving on the road. You can't drive in a taxi more than two people. You can't use mass transportation. It's all just, everything is shut down and people are supposed to stay inside their houses 24 hours a day, except to go to certain designated places to buy food.
So are all of your businesses, the folks that you've loaned to, are they all shut down, or some of them who may sell food still even open?
There is not one that I think can legally stay open now, because it requires them to interact with the public. Let's say you're fixing cell phones. Well, nobody can go out and bring their broken cell phone to you so you can fix it.
Sure.
So there's they may be able to make baskets, but they're not going to be able to sell them or deliver them wholesale to orders. So there's very little that you can do under this kind of dramatic shutdown if you're a small or micro business.
Yeah, I do believe those who sell food are allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's a 42-day lockdown now. So, and they have a curfew. You're not allowed. You'll be arrested if you are out. So schools are closed. So mm-hmm. the schools that rely on tuition to stay open, they're dying out there. They can't keep their school open because they can't pay the electrical bill because there's no kids there to pay their tuition to get into the school. So it's just a real domino effect that's devastating. And our partner, Victoria, is very fortunate because she has farmland that she's able to be able to get food for the kids. She can go out in the car to get food, but they try to stock up. But they have bills just like all of us do. just like all the restaurant people here in the United States. They have to pay the electrical bill and the water bill, et cetera. And they have to pay their employers. And if they don't get any business, they just can't do it. So it's really sad. And unlike here, where we are getting bailouts and support from our government, there's nothing like that in Uganda. There are a lot of people there who are very, very hungry.
And as you said, lack of vaccine. Are you aware of the possibility of a vaccine coming to the country at some point, or is that uncertain?
Well, I think we are aware that there is going to be vaccine coming. The G7, as part of their meetings last week, committed essentially a billion vaccines, but it takes a while to get there. And that's for the whole continent of Africa, plus Asia and Latin America. And of course, there are over a billion people in Africa as a whole. It's not going to be enough. But yes, they had ordered vaccine from India prior to the pandemic surge there. Of course, India now has canceled those contracts. It's keeping the vaccines for itself. Hard to blame them because of the tremendous loss that they've already gone through with their own COVID problems. So it's going to probably be well into next year that they begin to get this under control. That being said, it has to get under control. Otherwise, we're vulnerable too. A third of our population won't get vaccinated right now, so we're going to have to be dealing with them in 6 months to a year because they've gotten infected from whatever virus manifestation is there at the time.
And I do know of people who are getting vaccinated in Uganda. I believe 1% has been vaccinated so far. And from what I heard from one of our partners is that they want to vaccinate all the teachers. And so they're requiring them to get the vaccine. But unlike here, where we just go in and get it for free, they have to pay. And then also I was sent a list of costs. If you do get COVID and you end up in the hospital, you have to pay for all of your medical care yourself. So that's probably what happened in India. People weren't going to the hospital because they couldn't pay, for their hospital care. They have to bring in their food. They have to pay for all their medicine. They have to bring in their sheets. It's not like here. And then also there was information that Victoria sent us about the amount of oxygen tanks that are available and hospital beds. Nowhere even probably what India had. So that's why they really clamp down, and that is their only way. They do wear masks. They do, wash their hands. They have hand sanitizer and everything, but it's mainly going to be just don't spread the disease. That's where they're at right now.
Well, and I know, there was a commitment by this country for donations of vaccine, but from my understanding, it's the Pfizer vaccine, which has the challenges. It has to be kept at a certain temperature, which means you have to have the right facilities and equipment and electricity and all that to be able to do that, which obviously I'm sure can be problematic in areas that don't. I would like to take a moment to back up and at least prior to the pandemic, we talked about some of your challenges you've had. I think I would like to talk about some of the successes you did have prior to this unfortunate circumstance that we're now in. Can you, Pauline, could you give us an example of maybe one of the success stories that encountered?
I have a lot. The first person is Jane, and Jane, had a little restaurant. We've eaten in a restaurant, we're talking very crude. It's on a corner in a little trading center. And Jane got her first loan. Let me backtrack. Jane had several children, and her children were at Bright Kids Uganda because she could not afford their school fees.
And so even HIV.
And HIV. So Jane got her first loan, and she bought a refrigerator, and she bought some pots and pans. And we're talking, you walk in and it's made with rough-hewn wood and you sit at rough-hewn tables, but you got a really good Ugandan meal, hot, you know, well-cooked, and we really enjoyed it. And time went on. She kept getting more loans. She opened up an outside eating area. She expanded. And every year we'd go back, we heard more success stories about Jane. Then Jane started doing catering. You know, she catered an event at Bright Kids Uganda, which was just down the road. And we got these little packets with food in them. And she did a beautiful job of catering for this event for about 40 people. And then when we went back in January, she was dressed so smartly. She looked beautiful, her hair, and her kids were at home. She was able to afford their school fees, and she went to catering school. And so, she was able to offer more services and food for her customers. She's a real success case and just a beautiful woman with a lot of challenges.
You said her kids were at home. Is that because before?
She couldn't afford.
She
had to abandon them.
She had to. She had to give them to Victoria so that Victoria would try to find a sponsor and get her kids going into school. So now she was able to have her family together in her home. And she was able to afford their school because a lot of school fees, their uniforms and school supplies, et cetera. And it was just such a joy to see her. She's a real success case.
Well, another one is. That's a transformation.
It is.
I ever heard one in terms of someone's life. Lou, do you have a favorite
share? Well, again, there are many, but the one that I have in mind is a woman who was an acid attack survivor, which is a terrible thing to have happen to you. And again, she started from nothing. She had had some retail business experience, but we again provided her with loans and went through a similar kind of pattern. And she was very successful. She was trading in drinks. Basically, she ran a pub in Kampala right on the corner. She was doing well. It was a clean place. It was operational. It was not rowdy. But of course, once, pubs can be, not in Pittsburgh, of course, that never happens here.
Well, so, pubs are pubs no matter what corner of the globe they're in. Right?
Correct. So. Yeah. So, but of course, then she was, shut down by the COVID, in March of last year. And like many other countries, the pubs haven't been opened at all. She's been without her, livelihood now for over a year. So, we're waiting to try to get her back in business. But in the meantime, what was a perfectly legitimate, functioning, well ordered for a pub, orderly business, basically closed down.
Yeah. And I went there. Yeah. We took some friends over there and she had a beautiful outside area patio with umbrella, you know, umbrella tables and everything and comes out serving her drinks. Yeah. You know, and she was so proud of what she was doing. And you could see the pride in all of their face. And then another real success story, among others, are a man and wife, Charles and Ketty. They live in northern Uganda in Gulu. They were victims of the Lord's Resistance Army War. Charles accidentally stood on a landmine and lost his legs.
Half his body, really.
Half his body. And then his wife, this was before they met. His wife was burned in a village. The rebels would come in and just burn the villages down. And her hands are severely deformed and she has scarring. But they got married. They met each other at one of the, you know, rehabilitation places. And they're married. They have a baby now. And they're very happy. And Charles, all he wanted was a solar panel because he repairs phones. And he got the first loan. He was so happy. This was in January of 2020 and he was ready to expand. And Victoria was hoping he was in the basement of this mall area. It was so dark. And I said, how are you going to get this solar panel? he said, well, we're going to get up on the roof, which was like three stories high, and thread down the wire and to get his light. And because otherwise he just had a candle to work by.
And then carrying cell phones by candlelight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have video of that. I just couldn't believe it. It was dark. And then his wife took out a loan, and she's selling, she wants to sell secondhand clothes, but she also was selling vegetables on the roadside. So here's two people, you know, who are really struggling along, and their loan really helped them. And now I don't know what's going to happen, but they had gotten a second loan. This was in January. We were there when they got awarded it, and they were so happy. And so I'm eager to go back and see how well everybody's doing and see what we can do to help them get back to where they were before.
You know, I should mention, too, on your website, you as well, and I should mention, Pauline, since you are a filmmaker, you've done some videos of the individuals who have these loans. There's some wonderful photographs on your website. Could you give that to us, your website?
Sure. It's www.asasocialfundforhiddenpeoples.org.
Very good. So I do want to take just another quick break, and we come back. I would just like to talk about what you see as the possibilities for the future beyond this pandemic. And we'll be back with Pauline Greenlich and Lou Picard. And we are back with Pauline Greenlich and Lou Picard of the ASA Social Fund for Hidden Peoples. So right before the break, we were thinking about, you know, what comes next, right? With here on Essential Work, we like to talk about past, present, and future. And obviously the future, I imagine, is probably uncertain in a lot of ways with the pandemic and how soon things may get back to normal, whatever normal is, and however you define that for here, for Uganda, what normal is, and what normal could be maybe someday. So, Lou, if you could start us off, where do you see things picking up in terms of, you know, we talked about the pandemic. Once the pandemic settles down, whenever that happens, what do you see happening for the program?
Yeah, I think there are three things that are of concern. One, of course, is we have to fix all of the pandemic related issues, problems.
Sure.
As does everybody around the world. This is a worldwide phenomenon. And that will include fixing the broken groups that have been impacted that hold existing loans. And we'll have to do something about that. This was not caused by their neglect or is in any way their fault. And so we'll have to figure out a legitimate way to cover that. Secondly, I think we're concerned that, of course, the whole nonprofit sector is being impacted by the pandemic in this country as well as around the world. And of course, we're dependent upon contributions for the work that that we do. We're not a foundation. We didn't come in with a huge gift or grant or anything like that. We're operating on the basis of small donations, and that's hard. We're competing in a very tough world. The world of nonprofits, I think, is one of the hardest. So we have our work cut out for us there. And then I think we want to look at the issue. Right now we're working just in Uganda, and Uganda is really important for us, and we'll want to continue that. But I also think we are need to consider other possible opportunities, and we have a few targets in mind. We're looking at places where we have a link already, or where we have people that we could trust to work with.
Sure.
I think the most likely one is North Africa and Morocco, but also thinking about Guatemala in Central America and possibly going back to South Africa as well. But these are all ifs, ands, and buts at this point. And we've discussed as well about whether or not it wouldn't be appropriate for us to think about something in this country, quite frankly. we'd always get asked about why it is that we're working in Uganda when there are poor people here. And it's a legitimate question. I think we know the answer is that we want to make sure that people have opportunities that are less fortunate than we are. But on the other hand, there are real needs in the so-called developed world as well. So that's something that we're looking at.
Well, I mean, if you're talking Morocco and South Africa, boy, that the three corners there of Africa, and even Central America, and I can imagine though, certainly in this climate as a nonprofit with so many nonprofits, you know, and so many places asking for donations and money, I can imagine what this program, how positively it could impact other places, but putting it together is another story. One thing I want to make sure we do touch on is that you've spoken so wonderfully about the impact this has had on individuals' lives and families' lives. Can Pauline you maybe touch on what's the impact beyond just those individuals in the society that you've seen there in Uganda?
Well, it was interesting because we talked to Victoria on the phone yesterday or the day before, and she mentioned, we asked her about the future of her children's home. And she was saying how the Ugandan government now is encouraging anybody who has a children's home. They are greatly encouraged, in fact, almost forced to find family, whether it's close or far or extended. And so they're trying to close down a lot of these children's homes and place these kids, much like in the U.S., back with their family. And one good thing that Uganda has going is that they really support their extended families. I mean, they call their cousins their brothers and sisters. And they're very close. So what Victoria, and she has a wonderful plan in mind, is that to when these kids, somebody will approach her about these children, she'll say, okay, I'm going to give you a microloan. And so you'll be able to support this child instead of putting them into my home.
Okay.
And only the children that get abandoned and the police then will contact her to take care of them, will she resort to giving them, you know, a children's home environment. But she still, even despite that, she will search unmercifully for these kids' homes and far and wide to try to find their relatives or to find where they're from, what their ethnic background is. I mean, she's really very good. And Uganda law does require that. So I was very encouraged to hear that, because this then will give people a chance to feel empowered. And we all want to be empowered and feel that we're in charge of our own destinies and not, you know, not just thrown out there and feeling hopeless. So I was very encouraged by that. And I know a lot of people ask me, you know, why are we doing this over there in Uganda? And my basic answer is they're a human being. And we all are here to help each other because we're all human beings. It doesn't matter where we live. But also by giving these people a chance for a job and to become independent, really, and Lou probably could focus more on this, how it builds a stable country. And, you know, why would we care whether Uganda is a stable country or not? We really do, because a lot of terrorists do come out from that area, not Uganda, but in that region, Somalia. And by building a stable economic level where people are not poor and would be prone to, you know, being part of a terrorism group, it builds stable countries and happy countries. And I don't know if, Lou, if you want to expand on that, because I'm kind of into an area I'm not really well versed on.
Mm. Yeah, I think an important part of this, of course, is the fact that we work with the University of Pittsburgh. We have an internship program that ASA manages that sends graduate students over to Uganda to work on our projects and to work with our partners. We had scheduled 12 graduate students to go over in May and June of last year. Of course, none of them got beyond their computer screen and Zoom. We've got a group that would like to go over this year, but we're not open yet, and Pitt's not mm-hmm. open, so we're not sending people. We're hoping to resume that next year, because what you can do with a graduate student who's interested in international development is you can give them an environment where they can get involved, and this is not role-playing, it's not theoretical, it's not academic. They're out dealing with people who face challenges. You're dealing with money situations. You're dealing with crises. We have a lot of them, more than we can garner for the graduate students to tackle. And there's just an awful lot of learning that can go on. And yes, we do learn from what we're doing about thinking about the future. And we've learned a lot from the pandemic. I wish I hadn't had to learn it, but we did. And our students did. So we're looking to get beyond the individual that way. Because these are students who are going to go out. Many of them want to work internationally with international organizations or with nonprofits or other organizations that are working on human security issues or international development areas. So we're training the next generation of people working in this region, in other regions of the world, but certainly in terms of addressing human needs, human security, and economic and social development.
When you talked to, you'd mentioned that, you know, these microloan programs, you've talked about the possibility of offering it in other countries. Mm. Are you aware of success stories in other parts of the world currently or in the recent past?
Yes, and there are people practicing income generation who probably know a lot more than we do. But there are two cautions. One, the closer to the middle class you get in terms of targeting your support, the more likely you're going to be successful, because they have better training, they have better skills, but you're not addressing issues of poverty. And then more generally, there is a danger the microloans. This is not always an unqualified success. People won't be surprised to know that there are scams that call themselves microloans. People set up a quote-unquote microloans institute to lend money. They put the money over. They give them $500 and they make them sign a promise to pay back, or they will give up collateral. Their collateral is a house, it's furniture, it's TVs or radios or whatever few goods that people have. And of course, then the moment they get a non-payment or a late payment, they pull the trucks in and they take all their stuff away. And so there are downsides to this as well. And of course, the other downside is inability to collect the loans back to perpetuate the loan process itself. So, we find evidence that there are three levels of operation for human security: charity, philanthropy, and then income generation or social entrepreneurialism, sometimes called. And that you're going to have to use a combination of these. But generating income is important because it's not just going to be given to you. It, as we said before, a cliche is it doesn't grow on trees.
But I'm also hearing that dignity, folks you're working with are able to move forward and create a better life for themselves and their families, which strikes me as one of the most remarkable things, the potential things, and obviously successes that you have had in cases with this sort of program. You know, and again, here in this country, this should be familiar to some, unfortunately, whether it's check cashing places or whether it was unscrupulous loans dating back to the housing crisis, where people were given loans that, you know, those giving them knew they just certainly weren't likely to be able to pay them back, yeah, and taking advantage of people in that sense. It's not isolated to this country. It's elsewhere as well. As we ramp up here, could you for us imagine ASA 5 years from now, or maybe 10 years from now? What If you could paint a picture of what you could imagine, where you would like to go, what you would hope might be able to happen, whether it's for your organization or just for this idea of microloans in general. What?
Wow, that's a toughie. I just think because the last few months we've been sort of, you know, feeling low, you know, about where our program is going. I really would like to see, because I've been working in the north with Victoria. There's it's very interesting because sociologically, before the war, 1985, men were pretty much running the families. You know, everyone had their roles and responsibilities. Women were in their huts or their homes taking care of the family, and the men were out there doing their work. Well, after the war, the women, because a lot of foreign aid groups were coming in, they were giving money to women to empower them to get a business. So now these women are very strong. They are trying to get businesses going, and the men are not having the responsibilities they did in their home because the women have taken over. So it's really interesting to see what has happened to the whole makeup of the family. And then you have the women who came back with their kids, and the kids aren't being accepted in the village because they were a product of a rape in with the soldiers. So everything's all mixed up there. But I found a women's group who I find very, very interesting, and they are just so enthused. Even during the pandemic, they were paying back their loans, and they have a sewing group there, and I would really love to see that expanded. Women's groups, even men's groups, to empower them and to, you know, get out there and get a job and kind of start building their society back again. I would love to see that. I know Victoria is trying very hard in the southern part of Uganda where she lives, and getting these women together and empowering them. And I would just like to see that expand and become a very strong force in building up Uganda, because Ugandans love Uganda. They're very proud of their country. And I really do feel they work very hard to get just the little bit that they have. And I know that they're very hard workers, and they could be a real role model to other people, to how they have started with nothing and then to see how they've ended up with something. And with their, like you said, their dignity, they have their human rights back. They feel proud. And I've seen that with the acid survivors. They've, have their loans. They come in, they smile, even with disfigurements, and they're proud of themselves, how they dress. And I would like to see that expanded a lot, in 5 years, and to make it a very strong, viable groups that are, that can become self-sufficient and not rely on an organization like us to keep helping them, bolster them up, that they can finally be independent on their own. That would bring great joy to me.
I would like to see it expand to other places as well, one or two places, and also expand up, expand in terms of the number of people we cover, but also expand in terms of their size. To make that jump from a micro business to a small business, which is the difference between less than five people, a small business is 25 to, or perhaps even 50 to five, and get some of our groups into that upper category so that they're creating jobs, generating income for others in addition to themselves.
Well, very good. Either of you have any final bit of information or final thought you'd like to share with folks about your work or any of the things we've talked about today?
Well, I'd like to suggest that if they're interested, see the films. These are wonderful films, and I will say it, several of them have won prizes in the U.S. For documentaries. There are going to be more that will do the same. Just take a look at our website if they have a chance, and of course, listen to this broadcast, this podcast, for the final piece de resistance.
And please share it if you with other people. And And Pauline, if someone would like to support all the work that you're doing and the vision you have for the future, what could they do?
Well, there's several things. First of all, on our website, we have donate buttons all over the place. And you could
That's
donate.
That's always helpful.
That is. And we, you know, so we have a very secure PayPal and also something called Bloomerang. So, and then also we are on Amazon Smile.
Amazon Smile, sure.
So we're part of that as well. And, you know, we won't turn down a check at all. And all of that is on our website so that people can look at and see the good work that everybody is doing. You know, we have a very strong board who a lot of them, most 90% of them have been in Uganda. They've been impacted by what they've seen and what they want to do. Some are working internationally. So we have a great group, and Lou has a lot of students who are very, very interested in going to Uganda, and even volunteers. Volunteers can go. We've had mothers, fathers, families. We've had strangers that we've gotten to know, and they joined us, and they just want to just come and see what it's like.
Yeah, Pittsburgh school teachers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anybody who wants to come would be more than welcome to join us, tag along, and just absorb. We can also arrange to have some eco tours. Victoria has a beautiful island. Her family owns about 2/3 of the land. It's about a 4-mile by 2-mile island. She now has the kids there to keep them safe from the virus. But she's developed quite an eco-tourism and an ecological wonder there. She's named it after her father. And you take a boat ride for an hour in a real Uganda boat. You are there. There's no electricity. She has solar, and she's got places to stay. And it's very beautiful if you really want to get away. And so we can provide you links to take a safari, see the gorillas, or see just see all the beautiful animals.
Yeah, there's a Jane Goodall chimp island right about 1.5 miles away from her island.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go and see the chimps.
So not only can you just see what we're doing, but you can also enjoy yourself and see the wonders of Uganda.
Well, very good. So you can visit, you can volunteer, and of course you can give. So very good. Well, thank you both so very much for being on the program.
Thank you
for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And that wraps up our interview with Dr. Louis Picard and Pauline Greenlich of the ASA Social Fund for Hidden Peoples. You can find links and details about them and all of our past guests and episodes on our website, essentialworkpodcast.org. You can also find us on all the most popular podcast apps for your phone or device, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts. While you're out there, please take a moment to give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and write us a review. It really helps us out and helps others find us. Speaking of which, please share this episode with friends and people you know, especially out on your social media. If you want to really help us out, go to battleofhomestead.org. Head to the donate page and give whatever you can. $20, $10, $2 a month keeps this podcast going. For just $30 a year or more, you could also get all the benefits of membership with the Battle of Homestead Foundation. If you have any comments, suggestions, episode ideas, or questions, please email us at comments@essentialworkpodcast.org or leave us a message on our listener line. That's 412-326-9435. If it's good, we might feature it on a future episode. We'd also like to thank all those who make this podcast possible. In addition to our sponsor, the Battle of Homestead Foundation, we appreciate all the members of the program committee for their feedback and advice. Special thanks this episode go to Angela Bachman. She's there for us when we need help with all things audio engineering. You can check out all of her work at thatsoundgirl.com. Our logo is designed by Brittany Sheets. She's at bsheetscreative.com. And our original theme song and music was composed and recorded by Jason Kendall. Check him out at jasonkendallproductions.com. This is Essential Work, exploring the past, present, and future of jobs. I'm Nathan Ruggles. Thanks for listening. Talk to you again soon. 2021 has been a year of transition for all of us. At the Battle of Homestead Foundation, they have discovered new ways to advance their mission of heritage, education, and social action. They expanded their educational outreach to include a weekly online tour of people's history locations through the Charlie's Monday Marker video series, as well as far-reaching discussion of social and economic trends with the podcast Essential Work, The Past, Present, and Future of Jobs. They presented 7 timely online public panels featuring nationally known authors and historians. Topics included workforce shifts from heavy industry to healthcare, the women's suffrage movement, uprooted immigrant neighborhoods, protest songs in today's civil action movements, the 1921 Battle of Blair Mountain, historical roots of today's social philanthropy, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania's world-famous city steps. They establish a professionally archived labor history collection, thousands of documents, photos, recordings, and remembrances of labor history spanning decades. They co-sponsored the Blair Mountain Centennial in West Virginia, honoring a long neglected part of U.S. history with a landmark Labor Day weekend of events. They built a new and more accessible website, which you should check out at battleofhomestead.org. They did all this with help, the essential support of all the individuals like you who enjoyed the programming, appreciate the hard work of the citizens, workers, educators, and historians that make it happen, and value their mission to preserve, interpret, and promote a people's history focused on the significance of the dramatic labor conflict at Homestead, Pennsylvania in 1892. In 2022, they'll present a new round of thought-provoking programming. Membership, along with special donations, is essential to their success. Annual membership is only $30, $20 for retirees or the underemployed, and just $10 for students. Join now at battleofhomestead.org. You can also choose to contribute at any of a number of special donor levels, and donations are tax deductible. Membership also provides multiple free admissions to a variety of historical museums and sites in the greater Pittsburgh area. Check out the details at battleofhomestead.org. As this singular year comes to a close, while we still may have much to be thankful for, we also all see the urgent necessity of doing more to share our progressive labor history to a wider audience and inspire a new generation of activists and organizers. Your membership and engagement ensures that the Battle of Homestead Foundation will continue to do just that. Show your support today at battleofhomestead.org. In solidarity, BHF thanks you and wishes you good health, positive spirits, and both peaceful and joyous days ahead.